Hi, and welcome to the Imperial MBA Women podcast. I'm Sam Bonner, and in this episode, we are discussing the future of AI and finance. This week, we are joined by three esteemed guests leading significant change in how AI is adopted and implemented. Our first guest, Louise Smith, is the Chief Digital Officer at Lloyds and board member and chair of the Scottish Financial Enterprise FinTech Executive Group and appointed as a government FinTech envoy for Scotland. Our second guest, Rachel Kirkham, is the Director of AI Solutions for Mindbridge AI and a member of the AI Public-Private Forum, a joint initiative between the Bank of England and FCA to understand the impact of AI on financial services. Our third guest, Cathy Mulligan, is a strategic advisor and senior researcher who applies digital technologies to build the future in a sustainable manner. Cathy is a visiting lecturer at Imperial College Centre for Cryptocurrency Research and Engineering and an honorary senior researcher at UCL.
AI is an area that people have a really varied understanding of how it can be applied and the benefits and the opportunities around different industries and aspects of society. So can you each please introduce your area of expertise, discuss how AI may have been implemented, and what exciting AI developments will come through in 2021? Louise, do you want to kick us off?
Sure, no problem. So I'm actually, as Cathy would describe me, is somebody who leads big digital transformation changes, but that create new business models. And what I mean by that is how we combine digital and data plus the components of a business to drive a new model rather than create digital twins or replicate certain things in digital land. So I'm quite passionate about that, actually. So that's probably point number one. So I'm currently the Chief Digital Officer for Lloyds of London, which has actually largely been a physical presence in Lime Street. I think everybody knows where we are. Previous to that, I've spent the last 20 years delivering big transformations in retail banks. So one in Barclays and one in NatWest RBS. And in terms of where we were using automation or data or cognitive type capabilities, we were very early stage, actually. And I think that's point one I'd make is AI is used in such broad ways to describe so many things that AI is one of the most powerful opportunities I think we have. But the way in which we describe it makes it very inaccessible. So the thing with AI is for me is how do we get it into the hands of people so that we can get to the right use cases that solve the right problems and demystify the language around it because we're reserving it for the few. And the power is in the many. So for me, it's actually about how do we scale it and how are we using the power of those components to drive change? So Cathy and Rachel will be far more sophisticated than me. But what I do understand is we're just scratching the surface, but scaling it and learning is actually quite tricky. And I think we're in the early stage of that. So that would be probably where my focus is on the leadership of driving that change. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And Rachel, yourself, you work very closely. Obviously, Mindbridge is an AI-focused business. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, the area you work in, and how you've been implementing it?
Yeah, sure. So my role at Mindbridge is a director of risk analytics. So Mindbridge is a platform that ingests financial data, and we're increasing the variety of that data all the time. But essentially what we're looking for is indicators of risk, and you can split risk up in a couple of different ways. The things we look for are things like fraud risk, financial reporting risk, financial management risk. And what I find quite interesting about this like topic is actually there are just so many different methods and techniques you can use in order to kind of analyze data and come up with indicators that something is worth further investigation. And in the context of financial services, the kind of the use case is even broader than the kinds of data that we're working with at the moment. So for me, I think AI is kind of reaching a point where the methods are mature enough to be used in like a high diversity, a really large number of use cases, but actually like the governance and the framework around how it's used is quite immature. So the kinds of conversations that I get involved with at the moment on financial services is kind of, how do I implement this? how do I make sure that I'm considering whether there's bias in the way that the algorithm has been trained? You know, how do I make sure that I'm accounting for that and that I've got really clear controls in place to make sure that, you know, the service that it's being implemented in is actually operating effectively? So, you know, for me, some of the ethical questions you actually get around the use of this data and the machine learning, the AI in financial services is becoming increasingly important. So, yeah, those are the kinds of conversations I'm involved in at the moment, and I find them really interesting. So,
100%. I like what you said about the aspect of the maturity, because this is very new to a lot of people, and it's not necessarily just moving across to digital platforms, but understanding the technology and the opportunities that it can drive. Kathy, you have a much broader experience, and also if you could touch a bit on how you're working with the students at Imperial to increase their awareness and understanding, that would be great.
I think both Louise and Rachel have brought up some excellent points. And just to clarify, you know, I'm much more on the geek side of things. So I'm much more geeky in terms of my approach to AI and looking at what it can do for us and how it can be delivered effectively. You know, and I think there are a couple of things that are coming up most definitely around AI that it's going to actually, you know, really drive changes. So, you know, this idea of, you know, self-operating information technology is something I'm really excited about, right? Which is something you can really get with AI, where you start to think about automation and, you know, structuring of unstructured data. Actually, you know, AI could help us structure data that we don't really completely understand yet. But also, I think this idea of being able to understand AI and what does it actually do and what is it really doing on your behalf is a really critical aspect of what's going to have to happen for us to get broad scale adoption. So, for example, we, you know, have algorithms that are enormously complicated, but they're also self-improving. What does that actually mean in a global marketplace? Let's take financial services that Rachel was talking about. What does it mean when an algorithm can use data to improve its own operations? You know, we have seen examples where regulators have been called up by banks and been told, we're taking this algorithm off of the marketplace because we no longer understand what this algorithm is doing on our behalf. And therefore, you know, we can't confirm that we have regulatory compliance for this. It's a hugely interesting time for this technology. And I think it's also, you know, as Louise and Rachel both touched upon, it's critical for us to grasp this as a society, not just as engineers. And, you know, it's all about how do we explain this to people? How do we ensure that people understand what is actually happening when they engage with algorithms? And those are the kind of things that are really exciting me. You know, I teach at Imperial, the elective for leading real world change in digital transformation. And that's one of the topics that we discuss quite a lot. You know, what does this really mean for society?
Yeah, because what I was thinking as you were talking, if you think about it, we've used data because we've had to solve for some of the most vulnerable in society. And Rachel, you might have a view on this. So if you think about it, through the COVID intervention, we've actually been pretty good at using data to help the most vulnerable segments of society, whether that's basic groceries, whether that's identifying now the populations in what order, whether that's helping NHS decide on what takes priority in terms of. So if you think about it, we've used data in loads of ways. If you then add it the other side, we've actually helped people stay connected and collaborate in what is a very tricky situation. We've almost created a start point where data and AI can actually show for good, for want of a better phrase, and apologies because it's an overused term as well. But I guess the thing that worries me is how do we, because they are the most vulnerable and we are vulnerable at the moment, how do we avoid that step in a line? And I was thinking as you were both talking, if these things start to become self-managing, self-improving, that feels like whilst there's a risk, there's a massive opportunity. And I was just thinking, what's that opportunity out of the situation now? Because we've probably accelerated conversations that we've had for a while, but actually done something about it because we've had to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. We've seen the power, right, of data and its application. And I think there are some really unique opportunities. So, for example, you know, it would be fantastic if I had a self-improving piece of code working on my behalf to do my tax return. I would very much like that. My accountant, for example, might not be so happy.
With all of that.
Indeed.
With all of that. Most depressing time of year at the best of times.
Exactly. So the question for me, however, is, you know, how do we take the great benefit of all of these technologies, but do it in a way that we're managing for those unintended consequences? And so one of the things that I, you know, often try to think through when I'm approaching technologies and designing and implementing them is, okay, how would my, you know, mother or my father interpret this, if that makes sense? So how would I make it simple enough that my parents could understand it, because they're, you know, both quite old now. I think controlling for the unintended consequences of data is the most important aspect. And I think it's the one that engineers often don't think through deeply. You know, we tend to be very technology deterministic in our approach. You know, technology can solve everything. And then, you know, someone will say, hey, there might be an ethical problem with using all this data. And then an engineer's response, and I have done this myself, which is why I bring it up, is immediately, but don't worry, I can solve that for you with another system. I can just build you something to solve for that. And I think the human is the most important piece. And so my question back to you, Lou, is how do you think through the journeys, the customer journeys for people that are interacting with enormously complex systems, you know, in a way that helps them understand and work with and not feel bamboozled, shall we say, by the technology?
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, I think when people are designing systems, they need to be encouraged to think about the context in which the results are going to be interpreted and used, right? So sometimes, like, a really complex system is the best solution, and actually the interpretability or explainability of the models that have been used isn't really that important. In public service delivery, especially when we're trying to build trust, actually a simpler model might be more effective, in the sense that its accuracy may be lower, but the ability to explain it to the end user is higher, right? And I feel like I think any public service, that needs to be explicitly considered when you're implementing AI. I also think in highly regulated markets, I mean, financial services is one and audit is another, that need for interpretability / explainability, depending on kind of the context, is also really important. You know, I think it's quite hard for regulators at the moment, right? Because there's a lot of new technologies that are being adopted. And in the case of kind of self-reinforcing systems, that can become quite complex quite fast, right? And I don't think kind of there's a framework in place for people to be able to adopt that technology and really understand like the implications. You know, I think that's why like regulatory sandboxes can be quite important. So in financial services, the FCA has one. And that gives both regulators and banks the opportunity, right, to test some of these technologies in a safe space, understand what the ethical implications are, and in fact any other implications, and then come up with like a good solution. And sometimes it might be that actually this system is really great, but we're not quite ready for it, and we actually need to implement something a bit simpler and a bit easier to understand. So
I think the sandbox, and it actually answers your question, Kathy, around the sandbox, is a brilliant example of being able to get things off paper quickly and actually start to build trust and transparency. In fact, I am building one similar, because we are one of the biggest transformations in the insurance industry for however many years. And it's a data transformation program when you look at it. And we're one of the very few, we've been very public about exactly what we're doing. It's a strategy that's in the public domain that we launched on the 5th of November, called the Blueprint 2, but you can see exactly what it is that we're doing, because we want to build that trust and transparency in an organizational market that's been there for 300 years, that there's this massive brand attached to it. So you can see what we're trying to do, and it's not about replicating the brilliant stuff that it does within those underwriting room floors. It's actually about how do we use the power of digital and data and AI to actually create something far more powerful that's fit for now and moving forward. There's also some horrible history there as well that we've faced into, but I'm talking about taking the really best parts of Lloyd's, because it is absolutely very relevant for three issues that we face today: cyber, climate change, and pandemics, and we need Lloyd's to really take a core role within that. So I think for us, it's about how do we create that next generation of Lloyd's. And to answer Kath, so I think the sandbox is a brilliant example of bringing some of that together. In fact, and Kathy knows, I'm passionate about how do we drive those impacts in a helpful way to customers, whether that's making something accessible through the language in which we use, whether that's being open in the way in which we design and research. So a good example would be is I've now made all of that open, public. You can sign up, you can be involved in as much as you want to, or as little as you want to, you can just offer an opinion. In fact, if you look at the blueprint too, we've also broken the journey down to a point where you can actually feedback each step if you want to. Because it's about how do you take people with you and how do you create stories that people can step into. It's not about being perfect or right. It's about how do we build trust, transparency, and learn. So for me, one of the biggest things, and I think it's actually one of the biggest areas for AI, and it's not technical research, and it's not the mechanics of research. It's skills in research that really bring that human engagement. And for me, I think we're going to see, I mean, we've seen the rise of skills within data and the engineering side of data and the engineering side of AI. But I actually think it's more on the softer side of research that I think there's going to be a power shift around how do we start to bring these together to make sense for people. Because if we need to get it into the hands of many where it started, we need to break down the barriers. I mean, how many times do you speak to people and as soon as you go AI, they go, what? Is that robot thing? Or they go, oh, that's that thing that's going to do stuff to me. And it's so we're almost limiting the power of something that could actually be for good, but we need to create trust. So for me, I'm seeing more and more rise of skills in that research that converges technology, converges it in a way that makes sense for people. Because it's not about AI, it's about AI plus that makes it better for me. And that's why I get interested, and that's why I love working with Kathy, and we work so well together, is because we've both got very opposite in terms of mine's probably more on the EQ side of how do you actually get people to want to engage or pull, and then how do we position it? And I think that's where the power of AI is. Because if we get it right, it can be massive in climate, pandemics and cyber and social issues. And I think we're limiting it at the moment, and I don't know how we unlock that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I've been involved in a couple of conversations quite recently about trust and AI. And, you know, one suggestion that was posited to me was, you know, professionalization of data science and having people that have really clear skill definitions, but also that cover that softer research side and cover the ethics around the use of the methods that they're implementing. And I think there probably is a good argument for professionalization of data science. I mean, maybe it's because I'm already a professional, because I'm an accountant, but you know, we do a lot of ethics training as an accountant, and you know, I can see there being quite a lot of value actually in building a profession where, you know, they have a really clear ethical framework and guidelines, and that, you know, if they don't follow it, there's a some kind of penalty, right, for not doing that. I mean, you know, you can get disqualified if you don't act ethically as an accountant, and but that's one approach. It might not be the right approach.
Do you think people understand what this ethics thing is? Because I hear this all the time. It's like ethics and everybody goes, oh.
Glad you brought that up, because no, I don't think they do. The one question I always bring up to be really provocative when people talk about AI ethics is, whose ethics are you talking about? I grew up on three continents, right? Yeah, I grew up on three continents. I'll tell you something right now. The ethics of people in Australia is different to the ethics of people in the United Kingdom. And, you know, when I say that, people always sort of then ask me to explain, what do I mean by that? I decline to say, but, you know, but I think that the idea here is that we come to the world with our own preconceived notions and ideas, and we actually all, you know, we have to come to a common understanding of what ethical implications mean for these technologies. So, you know, Rachel, I really liked your comment there. You know, one of the things that I push for a lot is, you know, we need to rethink the way we train software engineers. you know, foundationally from the bottom up, what we normally do is teach them really a huge amount of math, teach them how to build an algorithm. And then as they walk out the door, once we've, you know, basically armed them with what is now a nuclear weapon, we say, oh, and don't forget to be ethical as they kind of walk out the door. I think that's almost a little bit unfair, right? To those software engineers. Yeah. So, you know, thinking through, you know, do we need professionalization? Do we need something like, you know, civil engineers have, which is very, very similar to accountancy, I believe, where, you know, you train, but then you are not allowed basically to work on your own until you've done another 2 years and gotten a professional accreditation to say that you are qualified as a civil engineer. Do we need the same for software engineering? I fundamentally believe that we do. What do you think, Lou or Rachel?
I think it's quite interesting. And, you know, and I never thought about when you said, because we focus on the mechanics of how do we upskill and how do we equip people to do roles, we don't actually think about that EQ side of things. And actually, to your point, who defines ethics? Because mine could be different to yours, because my values might be. And therefore, it's what classifies as good ethics and bad ethics, which I hadn't actually thought about before. I mean, I was reminded as you were talking about a couple of real examples within this space. So if you look at the Apple credit card, which actually used an algorithm to determine what level of credit limit you got. And I was actually connecting some of the conversations that Rachel then raised around bias in data. And what we know with that card was it was actually creating a credit limit. And actually there was this guy, and he was well known in the kind of fintech space or tech space, and actually published on Twitter, I'm a stay-at-home dad, my wife earns X, and yet I've got the higher limit. So there was clearly something going on there that had gender bias within it. I'm also then thinking about, you know, new technologies that were new in 2016, like face recognition, and the unintended consequences of it not recognising ethnic faces. And actually, it's old now, but it's still so powerful. The YouTube video, the coded gaze, which is just horrifying. Not just about bias in data, but to see engineers, ethnic engineers, black engineers having to code within a white mask because it didn't recognize their faces or categorize them wrong. And actually, that's the line for me with this type of opportunity, is we have to come back at it the other way and go, if the intended use was X, what's the unintended risk? And I think there are a bunch of people that we need to equip with the skills to go, but what if it was used in a different way? What would happen? Or what if it was used in whatever situation? What would open banking would be another one. Yes, the intended use was aggregation of data to help people see their complete financial picture. But actually, what was the unintended? And if we get people thinking about those things in parallel, I think it would actually accelerate and it could be far more powerful, far quicker. But I don't know the answer to that.
When we talk about building trust, we can talk about building it internally. But what do you think we're really going to have to do to build trust on a wider society level, especially within levels of community who don't have access to implementing these areas that will improve their lives? I know, Rachel, you recently wrote an article around this. Do you want to touch on maybe the areas that you covered, but also some of the responses you received to that article?
Yeah, sure. So I can talk about that a little bit. The World Economic Forum published a blog that I'd written for them on kind of the use of AI to improve trust in public services. And really kind of, although I guess two of the use cases I discussed would have involved personal data, the vast majority of the use cases I was talking about actually wouldn't have involved really any personal data at all. So really good example of that is I was talking about maintenance of the road network. So, you know, the UK has been experimenting with using predictive models to understand kind of using aerial photography, what is the state of the roads, and therefore, where do we need to focus efforts on kind of repairing the road, right? So it's a really interesting kind of quite exciting use case, I think, of image recognition and predictive models and actually making kind of public services better. And I think one of the really interesting things was the backlash on Twitter about kind of the blog. And really the kinds of Twitter comments that the WEF got was really, I think Twitter had seen AI and government And a lot of people would really just focus on that without like getting into the detail. I think it exemplifies perhaps the mistrust in the technology, maybe not among every group in society, but certainly among some groups of society. So there was clearly quite a bit of like PR work that needs to happen for AI to be used more broadly and kind of many different contexts, I think. It'd be interesting to hear Kathy and Lou's views on kind of what role does government have to play in this and what role does industry have to play, right, in improving trust in the use of AI?
Yeah, now that's a really interesting question. One of the big things that I think you can see with AI is a changing nature in the role of the interaction between government, corporations, and citizens. So if we think about the world system as we've known it for the last of, let's say, 200 odd years, what we've had is an agreed set of social norms. Government has had an agreed role. Citizens have had an agreed role. Okay, so over time we've had, you know, fortunately more and more people are allowed to vote, but we've had a democratic system, you know, at least in the United Kingdom and many other countries for about 200 odd years. And the interaction between government, corporations, and citizenry has been relatively well established. What we see with AI is it's not just breaking down the boundaries between corporations or the boundaries of the firm, but it's breaking down the boundaries of some of those established social norms. So what does it mean to have an identity that is now for a great, you know, greater or lesser extent controlled by an AI that is actually owned by a company? You know, for the last 200 odd years, I've got my passport from the government. Suddenly an AI is doing that for me. What does that really mean? What does it genuinely mean? Now, in order to create trust, I think what that really requires is coming back to that human aspect, which is forging a discussion across society that is not arrogant, that is not patronizing, that is not condescending, and that is not technology deterministic, because it is genuinely about all of the people in the world coming together or in a country coming together and agreeing the social norms that are going to provide the foundation of the social contract going forward. The other thing that I think we see a lot, and this is the interaction between government and corporations that has me really fascinated. You know, what we're seeing is the creation of massive global data monopolies, you know, who shall remain nameless for the purposes of this podcast. But what we can see also is a challenge to the established government structures. What we're seeing is corporations increasingly stepping into the role of government. And what does it mean when corporations are government? What does that mean for society? Do we want that? Do we agree with that? All of these are questions that are, you know, need to be asked of many people in society, not just engineers and not DOs. No offense, Lou. But, you know, this is a discussion that needs to be forged across society in an open and non-condescending manner is my point.
I think people don't understand it. I think all the real examples you've just actually articulated, but also those undescribed, undefined, non-evaluated roles that we all have, and those boundaries change. And it's like, well, what does that actually mean? And that goes back to me, we have to be transparent. But I'm also minded of when you were talking, Kathy. I mean, one of the early things the banks did was put chatbots in on top of FAQs. And actually, what I always remember when we were going through user research and testing, actually, customers didn't mind speaking to chatbots. What I could never get my head around was the reaction to it when it got it wrong. So when it knew it was a human, even though it was exactly the same scenario, you never saw anybody, but when they knew it was a human on the chat versus a algorithm on the chat, the reaction to the algorithm getting it wrong versus the human getting it wrong was beyond anything I'd ever seen. It was like exponentially higher. That tolerance was really low. Whereas the same scenario with the human on the end of it, with exactly the same answer, it was more forgiving. And that's the bit that worried me, was around the expectation matching of these things around what customers want to do. And we tested it in both a scenario where it was a chatbot on a web chat and a chatbot where you could physically see the person. Both instances, the reaction was, not just a bit, but like massively higher, emotionally reacting to these things. And I think if we are going to use those things, we've got to understand what's the expectation of people in terms of what happens. And I think that, I mean, it's an old technique now, isn't it? That straight matching of an expectation curve, you know, and I always apply it in my industry because I get it, you know, at the bottom bit, when you want your cash out the machine to go down the discotheque on a Friday night, you know, you just want your money and you want to go. You're not going to change your name and address on there. I mean, you get really annoyed if somebody was in front of you changing your name and address and your direct debits. You can tell how old I am. And then on the other end of it, you had, you know, people expected to have a little bit of friction around a mortgage. I mean, you would never give them a 30-second thumbing experience on a mobile phone and there you go, here's £500,000, go buy a house. You'd freak everybody out. So there's that kind of what customers, and then mobile, when we started to introduce new digital channels, kind of sat in the middle, but it moved. And it's moved even further now because actually people expect mobile to be always there. So it's that, what do people expect, I think is going to be really critical, not what can technology do, because we could do things much quicker than we have. But what do users and customers really expect? And I think there's a lot of work that needs to go into, because that will drive adoption. That will drive how we feel about using these things quicker, because we'll get more comfortable with what they do versus what we expect. And that, again, will shift over time.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really interesting challenge for the adoption of quite a lot of these technologies actually going forward. And listening to you talk about that, it made me really think about self-driving cars, actually. Like, they are probably getting to a point where they are more accurate than humans and are less likely to have an accident. But I reckon the burden of proof is going to be much higher, right, for that technology to get adopted. People will want a much lower error rate than a human would have had driving a car. I think we expect more from technology than we expected from people. And how we manage that and how we get the benefits from adopting technology at equal pace, I think is going to be quite a big challenge, actually.
Yeah, definitely. But I hadn't thought about it in that positioning before, that actually it's working together rather than offering the world and seeing what comes out in the wash, almost building on adoption. It's actually working much closer to what people can sort of expect, understand and apply to their day-to-day lives. So as, you know, there will be areas that could move much faster, but if we move with the rate of adoption, then that would be a much broader trust and people will feel that they still have that element of control, which obviously therefore increases understanding and capability.
Yeah, this is such a key area. Just because technology can doesn't mean we should. And I'm always conscious about that because people, we've got to get that expectation right, and particularly in this space from the start. It will change. But I think if we do that, it will change it in a much better way so that you accelerate the adoption rather than just because we can deliver all this. Like our phones, and Kathy always reminds me, I always have the best phone because I like it. But like, it probably does more stuff than I do, which is just a couple of photos and a WhatsApp, isn't it? Let's be honest. We never use it as a phone anyway. We always freak out when the thing rings, don't we? And go, oh, it's wrong.
You just touched on the thing I'm most excited about for the future of AI, which is that if you look, the thing I was super excited about in the iPhone 12 launch is that they've got an AI chip directly on the smartphone. Now, if you think about what happens the last time we got that amount of computational power into our hands, you know, I personally believe that the reason that we got something like Bitcoin or blockchain was because computational capacity suddenly became available. Okay, so we've all had these, you know, highly addictive machines in our hands. You know, we can't live without them anymore. I can see yours right now, Lou. So, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
And
that's my Bitcoin, Kathy. It was 200 quid. It's
now
934 quid.
Yeah. So I think the point is about that is that placing AI into the hands of individuals is going to be an extraordinarily interesting and challenging time for humanity. What does it mean when you put that kind of power into the hands of just everybody? That's what I'm really excited about, actually. And also mildly terrified.
And on that note, we're going to wrap it up for this week. Thank you to all our guests for taking the time to share their insights today. We hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. Please follow or subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast across Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and we'll be back with the next episode in 2 weeks' time. See you then.